From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. This episode, the presidential election is over, but does that mean a progressive agenda is beginning?
Liberals are already seeing it come true that some of their priorities may not be as sacred as they hoped.
And exploring America, the Arkansas Delta of yesterday, seen through a renowned photographer's lens.
The houses they lived in, the land they lived in, it looked like, you know, the great Mississippi had washed them all away. They're gone.
And discovering the Motor City on its third act.
It almost became a laboratory. Things had become so desperate that you could try almost anything in Detroit.
And the king makes music history 40 years ago, Elvis's epic Aloha from Hawaii.
The moment I saw him, I was in such awe that I stopped and I was just staring at my mom saying, "Oh my God."
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. When Barack Obama first took office 4 years ago, many progressives were on cloud nine. Here was a president pledging to tackle some of the issues closest to the progressive base, like climate change, gun control, and what he called our broken immigration system.
And I will make it a top priority in my first year as president.
We understand the gravity of the climate threat. We are determined to act.
We can make certain that those who are mentally deranged are not getting hold of handguns.
And those comments came in 2008 and 2009. Today, they're just a few of the unresolved issues leaving progressives unsatisfied. Now, with the second Obama administration soon upon us, some progressives are wondering if President Obama will reboot in this term. That's our cover story today. Progressives and the president, will it always be a glass half full, or even just a quarter? Sean Johnson is one progressive voter heartily disappointed in President Barack Obama. He's an assistant professor of elementary education at Towson University in Maryland, and he writes for a blog called The Chalk Face. He wrote a column in 2011 called Obama Lost My Vote. So we asked him to talk about why. He says that when President Obama first ran in 2008, he was an ardent supporter. He even knocked on doors.
I volunteered for the campaign in the state of Indiana, and I was completely elated when he won that state, the first time a Democrat's won it since 64. And so I was really excited by that. And I think at the time, a lot of people, especially within the education community, got all whipped up into anti-Bush sentiment and anti-No Child Left Behind sentiment. And so they were really looking forward to a shift in education policy. But there's not a lot of daylight between traditional Democratic and Republican educational policies.
What other specific things? I mean, this column, Obama Lost My Vote, disappointed you so deeply?
There's sort of a lot of other decisions that he's made over his, you know, first term. I know a lot of progressives were upset about the health care negotiations that he came from.
Because he wanted it to be single payer.
Single payer or a public option, and that was immediately negotiated away. I know a lot of people have been raising concerns over foreign policy in terms of drone strikes, in terms of surveillance, wiretapping. A lot of those programs have been continued. He's quite hawkish when it comes to a lot of his foreign policy. And, you know, I think he has been painted as this radical leftist by the extreme right. And he really isn't. I mean, to me, at least, he's more of a center-right president than otherwise.
Would a center-right president have repealed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law? Would he have campaigned and passed historic health care reform legislation? Would a center-right president have espoused and passed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act?
I think when making comparisons between Democrats and Republicans, it's all relative. And I think the conservative right has been pulled so far right that anyone even remotely centrist seems extreme left. And so I think he is looking in progressive directions, but to be called a progressive or a liberal for that matter, I think is a bridge too far.
Sean Johnson, a professor who blogs for The Chalk Face. Some progressives do, however, feel more optimistic about President Obama. It seemed like a new day with the election handily won and Democrats like Elizabeth Warren and Tammy Baldwin moving to the Senate. But Molly Ball, a staff writer who covers national politics for The Atlantic, says progressives are about to have their hopes dashed once again.
It's truer now than it ever was that the math just hasn't really changed in Washington. The Congress is still constructed the way the Congress was constructed then. Democrats made incremental gains in the Senate and in the House, but they didn't change the basic math. And that means that these policy fights ahead are going to run up against exactly what they've run up against the last 4 years. Even if Obama is feeling newly liberated by his reelection, he's going to have to turn a lot of votes to make any of this possible. And so, for example, climate change, people in the environmental community who lobby for these things, they don't even hope for climate change legislation out of this Congress. They have looked at the Republican House of Representatives, which, when it does anything on the environment, is trying to roll back the EPA or eliminate the EPA. And when they seek changes from Obama, they are seeking regulatory changes. They're seeking executive branch power to make changes. They don't even hope for a renewed push for climate change legislation for the most part.
Let's talk for the moment about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. They have been spared in this fiscal cliff deal, but perhaps not for long. What do you see with those programs?
What we saw in the fiscal cliff negotiations was that the president was open to changes on Social Security and on Medicare. And this is a way in which liberals are already seeing it come true that some of their priorities may not be as sacred as they hoped. Now, the changes did not end up getting made, in part because the deal ended up being so much smaller than the negotiations originally were for. But they were definitely on the table. It was only at the very last minute, that last day of negotiations between Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden, that Social Security was taken off the table. And the president had offered changes to Medicare as part of his original offer to John Boehner. So for liberals whose priorities are protecting those entitlements, I think they've got to be very nervous about what lies ahead in future negotiations.
You know, when President Obama ran for office prior to his first term, much was made of his roots as a community organizer, and he wrote about that a lot in his own autobiography, The Audacity of Hope. He really comes off in that tome as a progressive thinker. Do you identify him that way?
That's a really interesting question. I think on the one hand, there's no question that he is a liberal. But on the other hand, you also see, even in his early writing, this strain of pragmatism. And part of what was so appealing about him originally back in 2008 was this bridge building idea that he had, and the speech he gave at the 2004 Democratic Convention about being inclusive and bringing everybody in. Now, a lot of Republicans may not feel that he's done that in practice, but I think there's always been these dueling strains of Obama on the one hand as a philosophical liberal, and on the other hand as someone who really seeks compromise. Some of his allies would argue to a fault that he tends to maybe give away the store because he's so interested in building bridges to the other side.
Molly Ball's a staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Bernie Sanders is one who knows about compromise. The independent senator from Vermont objected to the fiscal deal, but he voted for it anyway, saying it was better than the alternative. Sanders is co-founder of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and he's the only Senate member. So I asked him, what does it mean to be a progressive?
What being a progressive is about right now is standing up and fighting for working families, fighting for low-income people, being prepared to take on big oil and big coal to save the planet in terms of global warming, standing up for women and gay folks who are under attack all of the time by an increasingly militant right wing. Those are some of the aspects of being a progressive.
By your own standards, by the convictions to which you've hewn, do you think that President Obama merits the term progressive? Is he progressive?
No. I think he's a pretty honest guy. And the president, as you may recall, just a few weeks ago said that if we were in the 1980s, he would have been considered something like a moderate Republican. And I think he's kind of a centrist somewhere in the middle of the Democratic Party. But no, I don't think he is a progressive.
How would you say his leadership style has changed since he took office?
Well, I was very disappointed in terms of his unwillingness to be more aggressive in standing up to what has increasingly become a right-wing extremist Republican Party. And we needed the president to really stand up tall against these guys in budget negotiations and in other ways. And he really hasn't, to my mind, done that effectively. On the other hand, I thought that the much maligned stimulus package was very, very important for Vermont and important for America. I think that the priorities of that legislation were exactly right. Rebuilding our infrastructure, helping to transform our energy system, paying attention to children, paying attention to veterans. I thought more money should have gone into that, but I think he deserves more credit than he got.
Would you have any advice, given your own background or experience, for the White House and the president on something like compromise? When you have right now the House Speaker is saying no more direct negotiations with the president, we'll see. No president, rules alone. Any suggestions for how he can hold true to ideals and negotiate at the same time?
If the president stands firm and says, you know what, I ain't going to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. I am going to ask corporations who are not paying any taxes to stop paying their fair share. He will have the overwhelming majority of the American people behind him. And sooner or later, the Republicans will catch on that they are in danger of becoming a marginal fringe party unless they get along with the program here and do what the American people want.
Can I gather that senators like you are going to be pressuring the president to do exactly that?
Oh, I think you can gather that, absolutely.
Bernie Sanders is the independent senator from Vermont. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, back to Sean Johnson, that progressive voter, blogger, and teacher who wrote the column, Obama Lost My Vote. We wondered who he did wind up voting for in the last election.
Ultimately, I did vote for the president. I think in the end, we have to be pragmatic when we go into the voting booth. And even though I'm heavily supportive of the Green Party's educational platform, ultimately, given the choices, I went for the president.
Yeah, but did you publish a column that said, ultimately, Obama got my vote?
I did not. And perhaps that's going to be a follow-up.
And progressives are still looking to the president to follow up on the liberal agenda that he laid out in 2008. For the first time since 1994, the Violence Against Women Act has been allowed to expire. The law gives police and social service groups money to help fight domestic violence and sexual assault. The sticking point for reauthorizing the measure was apparently new protections for Native American women. Those drew objections from House Republicans. NPR's justice correspondent, Carrie Johnson, is here to talk about the law. Carrie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So the Senate passed its version of the Violence Against Women law back in April, and the House couldn't reach an agreement, a not unfamiliar script in D.C. these days. What went wrong?
Jackie, the Senate actually had 68 votes for its version of this law, which means it was really a bipartisan measure in all respects. The House passed a different version, but it stripped some provisions from the Senate bill and in some ways, according to advocates for victims of domestic violence, set back the clock a ways. The White House said under no circumstances would it sign or approve the House measure, and that threw the process into chaos late last year. Vice President Joe Biden, who was a leading proponent of the Violence Against Women Act when it first passed in Congress, got involved. He tried to negotiate with House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, but they could not come up with a deal.
Well, what had changed, Carrie, in the legislation?
There were three new provisions in the Senate measure. This law dates back to 1994, and it's been reauthorized pretty much every 5 years without fail. And these three new provisions were more protection for victims who come from the LGBT community, gays, lesbians, bisexuals, transgendered victims, more protections for immigrants who may or may not be in the country legally, and finally, more protections for Native American women, women on reservations whose statistics show are the victim of violence most often from people who do not live on those reservations. And the tribal courts in Indian country currently are not empowered to hear those cases, which involve offenders from non-Native American communities. The Senate would have allowed that to happen for the first time.
We've heard a lot about sexual violence in Indian Territory, as you say. What was the objection to extending protection to them under this law?
The central nature of the objection was never fully specified in public. But from what I've been able to figure out from talking to people on the Hill, people in the Justice Department, and people in the victims' advocacy community, it was this notion that expanding some jurisdiction for the tribal courts raised bigger questions about the authority of the tribal courts. If you expand jurisdiction for one category, the category of, say, white men who rape or assault in some other way women on the reservation, where do you stop? Once you start changing the jurisdiction of those tribal courts, you could make an argument, and I think some House Republicans did, that there's no limit there.
So things got stalled in the House. Do we have any idea how this will impact women and victims of domestic violence?
What I've been hearing from people in the victims' advocacy community and people at the Justice Department is that the Violence Against Women Act mostly provides money, grant money, for training police and courts and prosecutors and for social service organizations that help victims. All of those protections will continue so long as Congress continues to appropriate money to the Justice Department and, Jackie, so long as Congress is able to come up with some solution to sequestration, which as of now is set to take effect in March.
Are you hearing anything, Carrie, about what might happen this year on Capitol Hill?
Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, says this is a top priority. And Senator Patrick Leahy, a Democrat from Vermont who sort of shepherded this bill through the Senate last year, calls it a disappointment and a tragedy that it was not reauthorized. He plans to introduce some comprehensive new legislation very soon.
That's NPR's Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Deep in the north woods of Wisconsin, lumberjacks still cried timber, just not as often as they once did. Across the state, milling lumber into good paper, the kind called knowledge grade for books, has employed thousands for more than a century and created a cherished culture. Then about 6 years ago, the mill started closing one after the other as a result of the twin threats of the iPad and China. Still, some hardy souls are surviving through grit and attitude.
When I wake up every morning, lace up my boots to go to work, come with the right attitude, that's the one thing that we can control every day.
Paper Cuts is the name of a series done last month by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Reporter John Schmidt begins by saying it's hard to underestimate how iconic the lumber industry is in Wisconsin.
There's a town called Hayward, Wisconsin, where you can still go for the annual August International Lumberjack Competition. The entire reason that Wisconsin became the nation's leading papermaking state is because it's got the natural resources that you need for making paper. It's got a lot of rivers, which you need to power the mills. Mm-hmm. In a town called Appleton, Wisconsin, they made the world's first operating hydroelectric dam to power paper mills. And you've got hardwood forests, which have been a blessing for the industry in northern Wisconsin. These yield these fine, tough fibers that are great for books, magazines, encyclopedias. That's what Wisconsin specialized in for over 100 years.
So these wonderful pages survived a very long time. In your series, you start to really look at things from 2000 on, and then in 2006 on is when mills start to close. How did the paper industry survive the beginning of the digital age, and then suddenly it didn't?
What happened was that with every recession that hit in the 1980s and throughout the 1990s and even into the past decade, the industry would bounce back and output and demand was greater than ever before, and a joke began to circulate. This paperless society sure is good for business. Amazingly, astonishingly, the paper industry demand held up right up through about 2005, 2006. There is a beautiful old 120-year-old mill on the Wisconsin River in a town called Nakusa. It had to work extra shifts to make the paper for the recent biography of Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. The irony, of course, is that no industrialist has done more than Steve Jobs to create the touchscreens that are putting the pressure on these paper mills.
And like a mighty oak, there is one survivor here who you profile of this decline. Let's hear just a little bit from your video story, John. This is Butch Johnson.
We're now just celebrating today, I believe, our our sixth year of keeping this mill open, and it hasn't been easy, we feel a lot of pride in what we've been able to do where other people have just sort of thrown in the towel.
Love everything from his accent to his obvious pride. Tell us about Butch Johnson.
Butch Johnson is a second-generation logger, dyed-in-the-wool, northern Wisconsinite, and he's from the town called Hayward. What we wanted to do at the very onset was avoid the journalistic cliche of reporting on a dying Midwest industry. One of the first questions we asked was, have any of these mills that have closed down reopened? There was just one. That's in Park Falls. Butch grew up there. It is the biggest employer in all the counties around it.
I imagine he's quite a hero in Park Falls.
He is a folk hero locally. He saved the town as soon as the mill closed and pink slips went out. The anecdotes that I had heard was that just about every other house on some blocks put up a for sale sign, and you could just see the town's economy begin to collapse. Banks did not want to extend any loans to Butch, so he scraped together a fairly complicated deal. It did involve some state subsidies from the state of Wisconsin. And then he had the mill back up and running within a couple months of its closure.
So how are they doing?
Butch will be the first to admit that they might be the next mill to close. But for now, he added some long overdue automation on the big paper machine. So they make more paper than they ever did, the higher quality paper than they ever did. They are eking out a thin operating profit. When you talk to folks in the Wisconsin paper industry, usually off the record, when you set aside your notebook and you ask them the question, where do you see this industry going, some of them will say, we're just waiting to see who the last man standing is going to be.
John, Paper Cuts, the series, follows the whole mill trail overseas to China. And it's kind of amazing because for a long time, paper makers in Wisconsin assumed that the Chinese market just didn't have enough wood to make paper. You go to China and you find out that that's not true. What else do you find out?
No one expected them to dominate industry that's just not sexy, an industry that is so 18th century. What China has had for so many decades were these quaint, old, highly polluting mills that made flimsy paper out of things like straw and reeds and bamboo. So it began to strategically nurture a paper industry. In China, in the classrooms, children grow up learning about the four great inventions. They included paper, printing, the compass, and gunpowder. It is a potent national symbol, and China felt like it was reclaiming an industry that belonged to China in the first place.
So one of the fascinating parts of your story is that a prominent Wisconsin paper mill executive named Jeff Lindsay leaves Kimberly-Clark, which gave the world Kleenex, to go to Shanghai. Let's hear Jeff Lindsay's take on things in his new role. And here he is from Shanghai.
It's been an incredible learning experience, seeing what China is actually like versus what the West thinks China is. So many fallacies and misconceptions. It's amazing.
What does he think that China has going for it that Wisconsin doesn't?
Jeff is an engineer. He's a man who's used to speaking in empirical terms. He's the sort of guy who got into the paper industry because you can do so much with cellulose fibers and innovate with them and invent dozens of endless new uses for cellulose fibers. My interpretation of listening to Jeff is that the innovation culture in China, in the Chinese paper mills, is very active. While Wisconsin was a leader in innovation, in paper, it lost that about two decades ago.
You found that the Chinese government doled out at least $33 billion in subsidies to its paper industry between 2002 and 2009. That's more than $4 billion a year.
But it's not just subsidies that the Chinese have used as a competitive advantage. They are an innovation economy. They've had to compensate for a chronic timber deficit, and they are crossbreeding and hybridizing and cloning species of trees that can grow to full height in 4 to 6 years and yield the same pulp that a Wisconsin hardwood needs in 10 times that same period. I think the greatest innovation that the Chinese have come up with, however, is that they've created the biggest and most efficient recycling scheme in the world. They scour the planet, literally, for recycled paper, which they then de-ink and repulp. The biggest supplier is the United States of America, so think of all those recycling bins in homes and offices from coast to coast. Every time you recycle a piece of paper, there's a pretty decent chance that it's not ending up in the United States. Not only is Wisconsin losing an industry, but for all of its economic might, the biggest U.S. export is junk that we throw away.
That's John Schmidt. He's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His series about the Wisconsin paper industry is called Paper Cuts, and you can see more of it at npr.org. John, absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for letting me be on your show.
When the photographer Eugene Richards was a young man, he left Massachusetts for the Arkansas Delta, where he volunteered in the small city of Augusta. Though segregated and even dangerous, the Delta still had vibrant local traditions, which he documented with his camera. Decades later, industrial farming has emptied the Delta geographically and, as he found through his lens, almost spiritually. That's what was depicted in Richard's recent photo essay for National Geographic when he went back after 40 years. When we spoke, I asked him about first coming to Augusta, Arkansas.
It was a sharecropper culture, and there's a romanticization of things. You got to be very careful because the people there were very poor and sometimes actually extremely hungry, lack of food, nutrition, all kinds of tragic underpinnings. But on the other hand, there was a spiritual largeness. And what we talked about is all the time, as poor as people were, they always wanted, they were working their butts off in order to have their kids have a better life.
Right. I think it says in the National Geographic article that at the time, the per capita income of the people there was about $68 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we're talking just 40 years ago, not 100 years ago. So as you return for this article with National Geographic, in which you've shot these wonderful pictures, what was flashing through your mind?
I went back for a couple of reasons. I went back ostensibly, and this is what I persuaded the editors, to look at the culture and if there was anything left of it, and had a lot of trouble initially. You asked what it was like. I found out that I couldn't even find the places that I knew.
You mean they'd been wiped off the map?
Yes. The sharecropper existence, the houses they lived in, the land they lived in has changed profoundly. The houses, they look like, the great Mississippi had washed them all away. They're gone. I recall one of the first times that I went back there, I went out on a road, and there was three houses that I used to visit regularly. It took me a long time to find the place that they were because now the old wooden bridge was now concrete bridge, on and on and on. But I found it. And I went around with my hands, it was early morning, and feeling around to try to find some remnant of these houses. And I remember I couldn't find anything, and behind me when I turned around, it was one of those misty days in the Delta morning. There was a 40-year-old man standing there, that's what I figured he was. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I says, "I'm trying to find, there was a plantation here and these houses are here." And he says, "I lived here my whole life and they've never been here." So there's, in other words, and I know that they were, so there's a denial of a lifestyle. But it's also, on the other hand, the manifestations of that lifestyle are gone.
Yeah. Wow. One of these pictures that you have, speaking of that place where the imagination borders and bleeds into reality, is a picture of ruby red slippers as worn by Dorothy. And they're inside a lucite box. And you write that they glowed like broken glass. Tell us about taking that picture, please.
There were three little houses in the town of Lehigh, which were turned out to be farm labor houses. And on the outside porch were these absolutely amazingly red glowing slippers that you recognize right away from The Wizard of Oz. And they were sitting there. And so I made the photographs. You find these things, and in your mind, because everything's empty, the houses are torn up, you say to yourself, maybe I should take them with me. But I've never been able to do that. These belong here. A month later, I came back with my wife, Janine, and was looking for them. And as we arrived at the house, a van pulled up, and outside, about seven or eight, absolutely, I'm not exaggerating, huge men came out, covered with tattoos, wearing torn T-shirts and military outfits, asked me what we were there for. And Janine pops up. She says, "I'm here to see the red shoes." And this tough, vibrant man says, "I mean Dorothy's shoes," which made me sort of internally smile. But they were gone. It was like one of those things that happen, surreal things that happen all the time to all of us who go on the road, where things don't make sense, but they do make sense later.
Where are all the people who came to work there? Thousands of people who were the descendants of former slaves, sharecroppers who came from around the Delta region. How has big agriculture changed things, and where did those people go?
It's been an out-migration, it's a classic out-migration to Chicago in many cases from the people from the Delta, where it just got to be too much. The schools weren't good for so many years. The racial separation was there, and the people wanted to make life better. And also, there was no work because big machines came in. So now you have tractors when you had people working in the fields by hand, so there was no work. Right now, I feel, when I was there, that all you have left is a support group, you know, for a large, massive agricultural business, and in time, these people will go. Basically, they're not needed. It's a disposable population.
In one of your last pictures in the magazine, we do see young children there today from a family called Kern, the Kern family. Mm-hmm. And they're walking down a road past a huge field, petting their dogs. Is there anything traditional still there? It used to be music and oral tales that binds these communities together any longer?
Yes. Everything exists, but on a smaller scale. The churches exist. They're spread all over the place, but they might have six people in the church, while the place would have been jammed before. The thing that doesn't exist is that feeling, at least in my mind, you know, you have an experience. You don't want to say that my experience down there, even recently, was everybody's experience, but there's not the sense of hope that there was before. And you could feel it. The kids, you say, what do they want to do? And they shrug and they say, nothing. I just want to, you know, live my life out here. Before, there was always that the kids wanted to get out. They wanted to somehow help their parents succeed, move out into the world. And that seemed to be gone.
That's Eugene Richards. His photography was featured in the November issue of the National Geographic, and you can see the photos we talked about and others on our website, npr.org. Eugene Richards, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Panic in Detroit, Detroit Breakdown, Motor City Madhouse, all songs Mark Benelli listened to while growing up in a Detroit in decline in the 1970s. Detroit is 139 square miles that used to embody the American dream. The auto industry, consumer culture, Motown, massive, beautiful buildings. So when Mark Benelli was asked to write about the Detroit Auto Show in January of 2009, he jumped. He then moved back to Motor City to chronicle a place that had lost over half its population since its peak. Over the next couple of years, he limbed the city from every angle, sometimes finding a dystopian moment like the under-resourced, overworked firefighters of Highland Park.
Firefighters are coming to places like Highland Park and Detroit from the Bronx because they don't see those sorts of spectacular fires anymore, and they come to take pictures in Detroit.
One of them asked him, what are you going to write? Fiction? Nonfiction? None, he said.
He laughs and says no one's going to believe it.
But despite an epic's worth of struggles, Mark Benelli says Detroit is an exciting place for dreamers.
It almost became a laboratory. Things had become so desperate that you could try almost anything in Detroit.
So he wrote a book. It's called Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis.
When I got there, I realized Detroit had become this poster city for the recession. I mean, reporters were coming from all over the country, all over the world, really, to look at the place. And I felt like as someone who'd grown up there, I could really bring a little bit more nuance to the story, not tell the same stories that are being told over and over. And that includes things like humor. I mean, Detroit is a very surreal, weird place. And I thought a lot of that was being missed by reporters who were just coming in for an afternoon or a day or two.
The weirdness, the surreal quality, the vitality. I want you to describe what it was like to come back. You come to Service Street, not too far from where your father had a business. You meet these really wild neighbors. Take us into that time.
So I ended up moving onto this really strange and interesting block where my neighbors included some longtime Detroiters, a guy named Ron Scott, who was the founder of the Detroit chapter of the Black Panthers, and now he does lots of work with police brutality. And then there are also people like Stephen Dorota Coy, who were these young artists who'd moved from Hawaii to Detroit. I joke in the book that that's possibly the first time in human history that that particular migration has been made. It's in a neighborhood in Detroit called Eastern Market, where there are still lots of working slaughterhouses and produce wholesalers. And my father was a knife grinder, so I would make deliveries on that actual block. I remembered pulling into that alley. So it was a very strange sensation to sort of so literally go back to a place from my teenage years.
In one chapter in this book, you take us into what is called the zone with a photographer. Could you tell us about that? What's the zone?
Yes, that photographer is, she's a Dutch photographer named Corinne Vermeulen. She's been in Detroit for about 10 years. And she's a big fan of a Russian film called Stalker that involves this mysterious area called The Zone. And so she calls this area in Detroit The Zone. And it's a huge swath of land, 190 acres, that had been a residential neighborhood once upon a time. It was raised by the city and was supposed to become an industrial park. The idea was lots of factories would move in. And nothing happened. So it's hard to really convey what it's like. You're basically 5 minutes from downtown of a major American city, but you're standing in these fields that, I mean, you could be in rural Arkansas. And you can still see traces of the old neighborhood. The sidewalks are so overgrown, they're almost invisible. But if you look carefully, you can see the sidewalks. Or, like, you'll notice a glimpse of red, and it turns out to be an old fire hydrant that's covered with grass that's 3 feet high. It's a surreal place.
So Detroit, as we know, is nearly 140 miles square. You talk about some of the schemes to try to reinvent the city, and they're pretty remarkable. Can you list a few?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the problems with Detroit is, you know, it was a city that at its peak population was 2 million. Now with this last census in 2010, it's down to just over 700,000. So you have all this vacant land, all these abandoned buildings. What do you do with it? I mean, one of the more intriguing things that's been talked about, not much progress has been made so far, has been this sort of right-sizing initiative. That's the euphemistic term they've been using. And it's basically the idea is to convince people, incentivize people somehow to move to denser urban cores. So then you would have the vacant land concentrated, and you could turn that into parks, possibly into farms. The urban farming movement has been really big in Detroit and has been getting a lot of press. You look at some of these renderings that people make of the potential Detroit in, say, 2030, and it's astounding. The big problem, of course, is there's no money.
Tell me about some of the attempts while you were there to carry on basic services that sound like they're out of Mad Max. You profiled the firefighters of Highland Park.
That was a crazy story. Yeah, Highland Park, I call it in the book The Detroit of Detroit. I mean, it's really this little tiny community entirely surrounded by Detroit. Once upon a time, the original Model T plant was housed there. So it was the center of the world. I mean, everybody was coming to Highland Park to look at this wondrous assembly line. Ford left, Chrysler's world headquarters left for the suburbs. So now it's a very abandoned city. And the firefighters, their last remaining firehouse was condemned. And so they moved into an old Chrysler warehouse while the new firehouse was ostensibly being built. That was 5 or 6 years ago. Some of them are literally sleeping in tents. They're working with so few walkie-talkies that they've come up with a system of hand signals when they're at a fire so they can communicate with each other. The trucks break down. It's astounding the circumstances they work under. It's also somewhat inspirational because they still go to work every day and they still, you know, they're still doing this job, and you have to really look at them with awe and admiration. I mean, there are interns there working for free, risking their lives, and the paid firefighters are making $10 an hour. It's unbelievable unless you actually see it.
Well, you've given us a wonderful tour. I loved being out on your bicycle with you as you rode through these neighborhoods on Sunday afternoons and recalled some of the great historical things that had been said about Detroit in a century gone by. Really gives us a vision. People were hopeful once.
Oh, yeah. You read some of these old guidebooks, and Detroit was called the city of tomorrow. It was the city on the river. I mean, when business was booming, when the Model T plant was really at its peak, Detroit was the city. It was the city everyone was looking towards. It's one of the great stories of the 20th century. I mean, this wilderness city basically rising up out of nowhere, creating modern life in the 20th century as we know it in many ways. Mass production, consumer culture, suburban sprawl, in many ways the American middle class. And then the fall from such great heights, it's classical tragedy in lots of ways. I mean, in this case, the character is the city. You see the seeds of the character's destruction. You see those tragic flaws early on, and it's completely undone. And now we're at the third act, and we'll see what happens.
And that's why you've called it Detroit City is a place to be, the afterlife of an American metropolis. Mark Benelli, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Jackie.
I'm Dana Suzuki Culbertson, and I live in Kailua, Oahu, on the Windward Side. The night I went to see Elvis, I went with my mother. And I remember sitting up, and at the moment I saw him with my binoculars, I was in such awe that I stopped, and I was just staring at my mom saying, "Oh, my God, oh, my God." And she told me, "Stop looking at me and look at the stage and watch."
Forty years ago this month, on January 14th, 1973, Elvis Presley, perfectly tanned in his high-collared American Eagle jumpsuit, walked on stage at the Honolulu International Center to make history, the first solo entertainer to broadcast live via satellite. In more than 40 countries, from Asia to Europe, 1.5 billion viewers watched the king in the historic broadcast concert called Aloha from Hawaii. For fans in the audience like Dana Culbertson, the memory still shines.
When he first came out on stage, you know, they start off with these drums, boom, 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 and then da-da-da, da-da-da, and then out he comes, you know, with Cece Ryder.
Oh, see. CC Rider, oh, see what you have done. I said, see, CC Rider, oh, see what you have done. Girl, you make me love you and love, 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 love. What I say.
Also in the audience was a graduate student named Neil Abercrombie. He was rapt.
It was 12:30 in the morning when it started. The place was packed, about 6,000 plus people. In our little arena here, and he was in his, you know, his white cape, and he had his semi-karate moves, and he sang at least 20, 25 songs in an hour.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Johnny B.
Now, he did Hound Dog, you know, Big Mama Willie Mae Thornton's Hound Dog.
You ain't no friend of mine. Whoa!
He did Fever.
Dana Culbertson was just 17 at the time.
You know, I was in my own world swooning and wanting all that too. I just loved him.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever.
Yes, Elvis charmed the girls, 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 and the boys, too. Neil Abercrombie became an Elvis fan after listening to R&B in his hometown of Buffalo, New York. So, of course, he was happy to see the king's genius on stage.
He did rhythm and blues stuff. And, of course, he did I'll Remember You, Coi Leigh.
Can you sing any of it?
I'll Remember You. Da, 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 da. He, oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah. The second he started that, people burst into tears.
I'll remember you long after this in the summer. Did you go? I'll be lonely. Oh, so lonely, living only
to remember you.
The reason behind the Hawaii concert was to commemorate the late Hawaiian composer Hui Li, who'd written the song I'll Remember You, made famous by entertainer Don Ho. Presley recorded the song in June of 1966, the year Li died.
As a warm summer breeze, your sweet laughter, mornings after, ever after, I'll remember you. To your arms someday.
Elvis Presley loved Hawaii, and he was happy there. He made three movies in the state with titles like Blue Hawaii. He held a benefit show for the USS Arizona Memorial, the ship destroyed in the Pearl Harbor. As huge as the 1973 television event was, one irony is that in the United States, you couldn't see it. John Jackson is vice president of Sony's Legacy Recordings.
It was the same day as the Super Bowl. It was Super Bowl VII, Dolphins versus Redskins. Yeah, that was the season that the Dolphins went undefeated, which was a huge deal.
What you doing to me when you don't believe a word I'm saying? Suspicious mind, and we can't build on suspicious mind. So if an old friend I know.
So I've seen your picture, John Jackson, and are you as old as Elvis was when he performed this concert?
It's funny you mention that. I actually am 38 years old right now. I hadn't thought of that before you just mentioned it. And thank you for reminding me, by the way.
And happy birthday, by the way. But how do we explain your fascination for a performer? You weren't even born when this concert took place, and you've become an expert in Elvis.
I was fortunate enough to have attended Indiana University. I actually, for my thesis project, made a CD-ROM about Elvis's life where you could see clips and see photos and read about him. And the argument being that Elvis really ushered in the age of the multimedia human being. And you couldn't just hear his music without seeing his photograph, or you couldn't see the photograph without seeing the motion of him on television, or you had to take in everything, or he didn't make sense. And then after that, everything changed, and, you know, the world is now a multimedia place. Oh, I mean, the whole show is just fantastic. I mean, you can tell when listening to the January 12th show, the sort of dress rehearsal show, he's a little bit looser. He's joking around with the band and stuff, which he was apt to do. But the 14th show, he just absolutely kills it. And, you know, particularly the famous performances of an American Trilogy, which was a favorite song of his that he did. And it's just one of the great performances of his entire career.
Glory, glory.
As we know, the King still lives amongst diehard Elvis fans, but those fans haven't done so badly either. Neil Abercrombie is now Hawaii's governor, and he still loves Elvis.
He was a phenomenon, and we're talking about it 40 years later. You're not going to have the Justin Bieber World Satellite Concert 40 years from now, you know, or Beyonce or something like that. These are passing phenomena. Presley was singular in that way. The word charisma was made for him.
The 40th anniversary celebrations of the concert are planned from Memphis to Honolulu, where they're rebroadcasting the 1973 show. If you're lucky enough to get there, you'll be joining Governor Abercrombie at the arena where it all took place on January the 14th. You too can say what Elvis might say if he were there. Aloha from Hawaii. For the week ending January 6, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Lauren Silverman, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Acacia Squires, Erica Morrison, Chris Connolly, and Wilma Council. Shula Newman edited the show. The technical director is Daniel Shukin, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Leiden. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for tuning in.